This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents For We Are Many, Bobbyverse, Book 2. Written by Dennis E. Taylor. Performed by Ray Porter.
1. Sky God. Bob. February 2167, Delta Eridani. An angry squeal erupted from the pile of deadwood. The two Deltans paused, poised to retreat. Seeing no further response, they resumed pelting the area with rocks. The individual I had named Bernie, his fur erect along his spine and ears straight out with excitement, chanted, "Here, kootsie, kootsie, kootsie." I moved my observation drone to the rear to get out of their line of sight. They were okay with me observing the hunt, but I didn't want to distract them when even a slight misstep could result in injury or death. Mike glanced up at the movement, but the Deltans otherwise paid no attention to the football-sized drone. Someone must have scored a direct hit with a rock. Screaming like an irate steam engine, the pigoid erupted from the entrance to its den. The two rock throwers sprinted out of the way and the other hunters moved up. Each braced the butt of his spear on the ground and placed a foot on the end to hold it in place. The pigoid reached the hunting group in less than a second, screaming in rage. The Deltans held their positions with all the courage of medieval pikemen facing a cavalry charge. Even though I watched the action remotely via a floating observation drone, I could still feel my nether regions puckering up in fear. At times like this, I wondered if I hadn't gone a little overboard with the level of detail in my virtual reality environment. There was no reason for me to even have nether regions, let alone for them to pucker. The pigoid crashed into the waiting spears without slowing. Fast? Yes. Smart? Not so much. I'd never seen a pigoid try to dodge the spear points. One of the hunters, Fred, was thrown to the side as his spear bowed and then snapped. He screamed, either in pain or surprise, and blood spurted from his leg. A distracted part of my mind noted that Deltan blood was almost the same shade of red as human blood. The other Deltans held fast, and the pigoid was lifted right into the air by the leverage of their spears. It hung in midair for a moment, then crashed to the ground with a final screech. The Deltan hunters waited for any more movement, lips drawn back to show their impressive canines. Occasionally, a pigoid would get back up after this level of mistreatment and wade in for another round. No one wanted to be caught with their guard down. Bernie sidled up with his spear in one hand and a club in the other. Stretching as far as he could with the spear, he poked the pigoid in the snout. When there was no reaction, he turned to his fellow hunters and grinned. Not literally, of course. The Deltan equivalent of a grin was an earwaggle, but I was so used to the Deltan mannerisms that I no longer needed to consciously interpret. And the translation software took care of speech, converting idiom and metaphor between English and Deltan. I had assigned arbitrary human names to individuals to help me keep track of everyone. Truthfully, humans and Deltans would never communicate without a translator. Deltan speech sounded to human ears like a series of grunts, growls, and hiccups. According to Archimedes, my main contact among the Deltans, human speech sounded like two pigoids in a mating frenzy. Nice. The Deltans looked like a kind of a bat-pig mashup. Barrel bodies, spindly limbs, large mobile ears, and snouts not too different from a boar's. Their fur was mainly gray, with tan patterns around the face and head, unique to each individual. The Deltans were the first non-human intelligence I'd ever encountered, in only the second star system I had visited since leaving Earth more than 30 years ago. It made me wonder if intelligent life was perhaps as common as Star Trek would have us believe. Bill regularly transmitted his news blogs from Epsilon Eridani, but they were 19 years old by the time I received them. If any of the other Bobs had found intelligence, Bill might not even have received the reports yet, let alone retransmitted them to the rest of us. I returned my attention to the Deltans as they began to organize their post-hunt routine. The hunters checked on Fred, who was sitting on a rock, swearing in Deltan and pressing on the wound to staunch the bleeding. I moved the drone in to get a close look, and one of the group moved aside to give me a better view. Fred had been lucky. The gash from the splintered spear was jagged but not deep and appeared clean. If the pigoid had gotten its teeth into him, he'd be dead. Mike made a show of trying to poke the wound with his spear.
"Does that hurt? Does that hurt?"
Fred showed his teeth. "Yeah, funny. Next time you can have the bad spear." Mike smiled back, unrepentant, and Bernie slapped Fred on the shoulder.
"Come on, don't be a baby. It's almost stopped bleeding."
"Right, let's get this thing hung and bled."
Matching action to words, Mike unwound his rope from around his torso. He flipped the rope over a convenient tree branch, and Bernie tied the rear legs of the carcass. Knot making skills? Not so good. The rope work was rudimentary and probably slipped occasionally. I made a mental note to teach Archimedes some sailing knots. Mike and Bernie strung up the carcass and proceeded to field dress their kill while the other Deltans started a giving thanks chant. As I watched, I had one of those incongruous moments where I half expected them to attach a hunting tag to its ear. Wrong century, wrong planet, wrong species, of course. I turned away from the drone's video window and chuckled as I picked up my coffee. Marvin, who had been watching over my shoulder, gave me a strange look, but I didn't feel the need to explain. Hell, he should be able to remember original Bob going hunting with Dad way back when. I shrugged at him without comment. "Work it out, dude." Marvin rolled his eyes and returned to the lazy boy that he always materialized when he was visiting my VR. I spared a moment to let Jeeves refresh my coffee. As in every virtual reality space that implemented the Jeeves AI, he resembled John Cleese in Tucks and Tales. As I took a sip, perfect, as always, I looked around the library from my seat in one of the antique wing-back chairs. Floor-to-ceiling bookshelves, a large, old-fashioned fireplace, and tall, narrow windows through which a perpetual late-afternoon sun shone to illuminate the interior. And like a giant, shiny, black eye, one red, corduroy, lazy boy, occupied by a clone of yours truly. All in VR, of course. Physically, Marvin and I were a couple of glowing optoelectronic cubes installed in the two spaceships currently orbiting Delta Eridani 4, but we had been human once, and our VR environments kept us sane. Spike wandered over, jumped up onto Marvin's lap, and began to purr. The cat's AI was realistic, right down to the total lack of loyalty. I gave a small snort of amusement and turned back to the video window. The hunters had finished field dressing their kill. The pigoid didn't really look like a wild boar. It was probably closer to a bear in general outline, but it filled the same ecological niche as a boar, complete with the same sunny disposition and affectionate behavior. Hunting them wasn't a one-sided proposition by any means. The Deltans took a chance on every pigoid hunt. The pigoid usually lost, but it sometimes managed to take down one or two of the hunters. The recent addition of flint tips to the spears was changing the game, though. "Yeah, I know, prime directive, blah, blah, pfft. This wasn't Star Trek, despite Riker's choice of name and VR theme." The Deltans trussed their prize to a couple of spears, and four of them hoisted the ends of the spears to their shoulders. Mike beckoned with a gesture, and I maneuvered the drone over to float along beside him. Two others put their arms around Fred and helped him to his feet. His leg hadn't quite stopped bleeding, and he showed a pronounced limp, but he'd make it back to the village. We marched triumphantly toward the Deltans' home, a couple of the hunters singing a victory chant. The others traded good-natured jokes and insults as they compared notes. I never ceased to be amazed at how very similar in behavior the Deltans were to humans. It made me feel nostalgic occasionally for genuine human contact. We soon arrived at the village, greeted by laughter and celebration. A pigoid kill was always a happy event. The Hexgi would have a feast tonight and would eat well for a week. Hexgi translated as something like families of our fire. Of course, it flowed a lot better in Deltan. The hunting group was part of Archimedes' Hexgi, which I'd more or less adopted as family. Fred was helped over to his family spot, where his mate proceeded to fuss over him. One of the hunters hurried off to get the medicine woman, Cruella. I sighed and prepared myself for yet another argument with her. The messenger returned moments later with Cruella and her apprentice in tow. Cruella bent down to examine the wound, and I brought the drone in close. Too close, I guess. Cruella straight-armed the drone, and it shot back several feet before the AIMI controller was able to stabilize it. The other Deltans stepped back in shock, and one looked like he was going to either flee or faint. The drone was small and really not hard to push around, but still, you know, Sky God. I'd long since learned that the medicine woman feared no one and nothing, and she wasn't particularly good at taking advice either. I gritted my teeth in frustration, wondering if this time Cruella would pay attention to anything that I'd told her. Fred apparently was having the same thought. "This would be a good time to try Bob's hot water thing," he said to her. Cruella glared at him, then at my drone.
"Maybe he can just dress the wound as well, since you don't seem to need me."
"Oh, by the balls of my ancestors, Cruella," Mike said. "Try something new. Just once. Bob hasn't steered us wrong yet."
Cruella snarled at him. Within moments, the hunters and Cruella had faced off in a yelling match. The hunters were my biggest supporters. Flint tips, spear straighteners, and hand axes were only a few of the improvements that I'd brought to their lives. They, at least, trusted that I had the Deltans' best interests at heart. Finally, Cruella threw her hands in the air and barked,
"Fine, we'll do it your way. And if your leg falls off, don't come whining to me."
She turned to her apprentice and snarled an order. The apprentice flattened her ears and ran off. Minutes later, she was back, carrying a bladder and a soft leather skin. Cruella pointed to the bladder and said,
"Freshly boiled water."
She held up the soft piece of scraped skin and said,
"Washed in boiling water."
Then she glared right into the drone's camera.
"Now stay out of my way."
I watched, in pleased surprise, as she took the time to clean the wound with the piece of hide, using the freshly boiled water. This was progress. Granted, the hunters helped a lot by putting their collective foot down, but if Cruella got into the habit, incidence of infection would drop dramatically. I bobbed the drone once in acknowledgement, then sent it off to station keeping at the perimeter of the village. I returned to my VR once again, sat back, and closed the drone's video window. The change in procedure by the medicine woman was a major victory, and I was happy to get out of her way in return. It would allow her to save face, and she wouldn't feel the need to dig in her heels next time. I'd miss the rest of the celebration, but the pigoid's ultimate fate was a matter of routine, and well documented. And probably delicious. I thought of ribs in barbecue sauce, and my mouth watered. I didn't need food anymore, being a computer and all, but I could do anything I wanted in VR. And if you're going to program in a coffee simulation, you might as well program in barbecued ribs. Spike came walking across my desk, meowed once, and plunked down on my keyboard. I accepted a coffee refill from Jeeves, then turned to Marvin. "Okay, excitement's over. What's up? You wanted to talk to me about something?" Marvin nodded and stood. He dismissed the lazy boy and walked over to my work desk. Pulling up a wing back, he invoked a globe of Eden in midair over the desk with a small section of one continent outlined in red.
"This is the current range of the Deltans. I've excluded the old village since they no longer live there."
"And that was more of a refuge than a permanent home," I nodded. "They hadn't even been there for a full generation." Marvin bobbed his head in acknowledgement.
"Anyway, I've been doing a lot of digging, literally in some cases, and I've arrived at a reasonable estimate of Deltan population movements over time."
He looked at me expectantly, and I made a rolling motion with my hand for him to continue.
"They do not appear to be from this area at all. It looks as though the sentient Deltan subspecies originated here."
Marvin rotated the globe and pointed to a different part of the continent.
"And moved from there to the current location."
"And they're no longer at the old location? Why?"
"That's what I don't get, Bob. I found a lot of evidence of abandoned Deltan villages and some burial sites, but not nearly enough graves to account for the expected population."
"Predation, you'd think, but then we'd find Deltan remains here and there. at least in the form of piles of bones. You've seen what the gorilloids leave behind when they're done with a meal. They're not fastidious. I rubbed my chin, gazing at the globe. That doesn't make sense, anyway. From your notes, the original area didn't have gorilloids at all, so they moved from a safer area to a more dangerous area and disappeared in the safer area. Then fled the more dangerous area to set up in an even more dangerous area. Marvin shook his head in confusion. They aren't morons. They may be just in the process of becoming human-level sentient, but they have common sense. We're missing something. I shrugged and sent the globe spinning with a flick of a finger. It's a mystery, Marvin, and we do love a mystery. We exchanged grins. After all, Bob. But the important thing is that they're much safer here compared to where we found them. They've settled in nicely in Camelot. The hunting's good, and the gorilloids are beginning to get the hint and have pretty much stopped trying to pick off Deltans. You're really going to call their village Camelot? Marvin gave me the stink eye. Every time you say it, I hear Knights of the Round Table. I grinned at him and waggled my eyebrows. It's only a model. Marvin rolled his eyes and stopped the globe. Anyway, I'll keep at this, but we're at a disadvantage here. On Earth, scientists were building up from existing knowledge of a world they understood. On Eden, we're starting from scratch. Yeah? And even then it took years for them to figure out things like the fate of the Anasazi. I sat back and shook my head. Yeah, I get it, Marv. I have to admit, I'm glad this is a pet project for you. I did some basic research and exploration when I landed, but it wasn't a priority for me. Marvin chuckled and, with a parting nod, disappeared back to his own VR. 2. Colony Site. Howard, September 2188, Vulcan. Colonization of a new planet was always so easy in science fiction. Actually, scratch that, it was never easy. Something always came out of the woodwork to endanger the colony. Well, they got one thing right, sort of. On the plus side, nothing was bursting out of people's chests. However, setting up a human colony on Vulcan was turning out to be a little bit like being pecked to death by ducks. Large ducks with teeth and claws. Milo's notes and planetary catalog made it very clear that setting up would require attention to defensive strategies. The ecosystem was prolific and competitive. The colony ships Exodus 1 and 2 orbited Vulcan, most of the colonists from the USE enclave still in stasis, waiting for the settlement teams to prepare a site. Construction teams, security teams, and engineers worked day and night to clear enough jungle and build a home for this first wave of humanity. The USE colonists would also be expected to provide some support to future colony ships. Exodus 3 was only a few months behind us, and more would be coming as fast as Riker could build them. Like we needed the extra pressure. 5 days after humans set foot on Vulcan, the planet claimed its first casualty.
Message from the security chief. There has been an attack.
I nodded to Guppy, acknowledging the information. I took a moment to minimize the monitoring window that had been floating in the air in front of me and ordered the construction AMEs to continue on their own. They could handle most of the tasks involved in building the orbiting farm donut, and they would text me if they ran into something above their pay grade. I turned in my chair and raised an eyebrow at Guppy, inviting more information. But the Guppy system interface, in the form of an avatar resembling Admiral Akbar, wasn't inclined to volunteer anything beyond the basic facts. Huge fish eyes blinked at me, waiting for a command. Accepting the inevitable, I motioned with my hand, and he pushed the video window to me. The window showed the head of security, Stéphane Brodeur, with that look people get when they're on an adrenaline high. Wide eyes, slight sheen of sweat, nostrils dilated. He began to speak as soon as he saw me.
There has been an attack. The theropod-like predators that we've tagged as raptors. Northwest corner at the fence construction boundary.
Brodeur spoke with a pronounced Quebecois accent. I wondered idly how he had managed to get into the USE colony, but dismissed the question as irrelevant. I frame-jacked for a moment and sent a couple of drones to the fence construction area, then returned my frame rate to normal. A human being wouldn't even notice the millisecond glitch in my image. Casualties?
One.
Dead?
No, but he will need the new paint job. Brodeur grinned at me.
I raised an eyebrow and he continued.
A small group of raptors attacked the backhoe. The equipment will need the paint touched up. We killed most of the animals and the rest ran off. One of the carcasses is being sent to Dr. Sheehy for necropsy.
So, what can I do? The security chief shook his head.
About the attack, nothing. It's done, and we've taken care of the attackers. I'm hoping you can set up surveillance of some kind.
A reasonable request. I nodded in thought. Mr. Brodeur, I have some drones I can put on guard duty now, although they aren't really optimized for that. Bill, over in Epsilon Eridani, has been refining surveillance and exploration drones for a couple of decades now. I'll get some plans from him and start printing up something suitable. It'll take a week or two before they're ready. Can you hold out?
I will talk to the construction chief and see if we can cut back on some of the tasks until you're done. We would be spread too thin right now.
Do that, Chief. I'll keep you updated. I closed the connection and sent an email to Bill, requesting information on his observation drones. He designed them more for use by Bob's exploring new systems, but they do fine for my purposes as well. Security personnel were still swarming the area when my drones arrived at the fence construction site. Blood covered the ground, fortunately all raptor. A very sad-looking backhoe sat off to one side, long scrapes and scratches marring the bright yellow paint job. I wondered idly if the backhoe's AIMI controller would need therapy. Personnel were hauling several carcasses into the back of transport trucks. The raptors resembled movie velociraptors closely enough to give nightmares to anyone who'd seen Jurassic Park, but instead of the peg-like teeth of the canonical carnosaur, their teeth resembled those of sharks, triangular, serrated, and razor-sharp. So far, the use of military-grade automatic weapons on them hadn't blunted their enthusiasm for the newly arrived food group. I found Chief Brodeur overseeing the cleanup and floated over to him. He turned as the drone approached and grinned.
And to think I turned down the desk job.
I chuckled politely in response. Welcome to the frontier. Did you get all of them?
No. He shook his head. We let one or two get away to communicate fear of humans to their friends.
And how's that working out so far? Chief Brodeur laughed and shook his head.
I have a meeting with the colonel this afternoon. Perhaps you could attend.
He's already invited me, Mr. Brodeur. I'll see you there. Chief Brodeur nodded to the drone, then turned back to help his staff with cleanup. I took the opportunity to inspect the progress on construction. A fence stretched about a third of the way around the planned town site. 5 meters tall, it was built from a combination of native wood and metal. The Vulcan trees were close enough to their Terran equivalents that the setup crews were able to adapt them with little effort. The trees were harvested from the area immediately around the fence, forming a clear cut for additional security. I had my doubts about whether the fence was tall enough to keep the Brontos at bay, but no one had asked me. Not that the Brontos would eat people or anything. They were more of an accidentally step-on-you kind of danger. To the west, Vulcan's sister planet Romulus hung in the sky, clouds and seas clearly visible. When Exodus 3 arrived, the passengers from the Faith and Spitz enclaves would be settling there. I expected life to get very interesting once the Faith colony got started. I doubted that 19 years of stasis would improve Minister Cranston's disposition. The Faith leader wasn't what I'd call a people person to begin with, and his relationship with the Bobs had developed into kind of a hate-hate thing. I sent another drone up a few hundred meters and set it to circle the area, watching for any movement of native life. Nothing lurked nearby, probably due to the noise of the automatic weapons. Things appeared to have calmed down, and everyone was back to work. I backed out of the drone and back into my VR. Sighing, I rubbed my forehead. Sometimes I missed sleeping for a third of each day. It had been a nice break from reality. Guppy? I have some printer schedule changes. Guppy popped in and waited silently for me to continue. Looking at him, I wondered if I should change the Admiral Akbar image. But nothing else came to mind, and anyway, it had become a kind of tradition with the Bobs. We need more observation drones.
All printer groups are currently engaged in producing parts for the orbiting farms. Do you want to bump this activity?
Not really. Okay, put half the printers on drones and produce 4 full squads, then back to building the farm donuts.
Aye.
Guppy went into command fugue while he reprogrammed the 3D printers. I turned back to the video windows from my active drones. I would build more drones as requested, but I had a bad feeling that we'd go through a few colonists before we got the fence completed. Good afternoon, Colonel. The video window showed Colonel Butterworth, as usual, looking impeccable and wrinkle-free. I wondered how he did it.
Morning, Howard.
He nodded toward my image on his desk phone.
Good to see you. I heard about today's attack.
I took a moment to be surprised. I didn't remember Colonel Butterworth ever greeting Riker with that level of friendliness back on Earth. I wasn't sure if I should be offended for Riker or pleased for me. The leader of the USE enclave had been at odds with Riker since day one. I had all Riker's memories of those days, of course, right up to the moment that Riker had cloned me. It would be an understatement to describe Butterworth as pushy, although at least he was always professional. With a mental shrug, I decided not to worry about it. Different time, different place, and let's face it, I wasn't Riker. Yeah, but we won't be so lucky next time, I replied. The Raptors are smart. They'll figure out the backhoes aren't edible. If they've got good color vision, a high likelihood, they'll probably associate bright yellow with inedible things with hard shells. Then they'll start concentrating on the soft and squishy two-legged things. Butterworth snorted.
I saw your immediate strategy with the drones. I'm just reading your plan for observation and surveillance systems. Looks comprehensive. I have a few small suggestions which we can go over when convenient.
I nodded without comment. The colonel's suggestions would be good ones, and I'd very likely implement them. So, where's Mr. Brodeur? Wasn't he supposed to be here?
He was,
the colonel shrugged.
Something came up. I'll debrief him separately and call you if anything requires more discussion.
I nodded, then glanced over the colonel's shoulder, where the townsite plan was posted on the far wall. I motioned at it with my chin. Kind of old school, isn't it? A paper poster tacked up on a wall?
Hard copy still has its place, Howard. It's much bigger than an image on a tablet, and I can make notes on it with a color marker. Of course, I also take a picture, periodically.
The colonel gave me his trademark dry smile.
In other news, we are ready to decant the farming specialists from stasis. Mr. Brodeur tells me that they will have the farm area enclosed within a week.
Good. Bert and Ernie are getting antsy about unloading everyone soon. Butterworth winced as I mentioned the two colony ship bobs. I wasn't sure which was more amusing, that he disapproved so much over our naming choices or that he recognized the reference.
Another month or so, Howard. Then we can make that decision with confidence.
The colonel reached forward out of frame.
And maybe by the time Exodus 1 and Exodus 2 get back to Earth for another load, someone will have found another habitable system and they'll stop shipping people our way.
Without waiting for a response, he ended the call. 3. Life in Camelot. Bob, March 2167, Delta Eridani. Archimedes placed the bone tool with care and tapped it with a rock. A flick of flint dropped off the core, and Moses nodded in approval. Archimedes repositioned the tool for his next strike and glanced at Moses with his ears pointed slightly forward. Moses made a small hand motion. Archimedes moved the tool a fraction to the left, and his ears curled with concentration as he again tapped on the tool. The other Delton adolescent, whom I'd named Richard, watched Archimedes, then tried to copy his technique. But the tool slipped off the cobble and stabbed into his foot. He leapt up and hopped on the other foot, cursing with enthusiasm. After a few moments, Richard noticed Archimedes' grin and scowled. Snarling, he compared Archimedes to pigoid droppings, then stalked off limping. Moses and Archimedes were the tribe's best flint experts and toolmakers,
and based on Richard's performance, still the only ones.
Archimedes was a teenager by Delton standards, past puberty but not yet fully grown. He was, however, easily the most intelligent Deltan in the village, which meant, based on our searches, the most intelligent Deltan on the entire planet of Eden. Archimedes was the first Deltan in years, it seemed, who could understand Moses' flint-napping instructions. A couple of juveniles like Richard had shown some interest but couldn't maintain the level of concentration required to complete a tool. Very likely Archimedes would have to wait for some of his own progeny before he'd be able to attract any apprentices of his own. "Moses isn't looking so good," Marvin commented, looking over my shoulder. "Yeah, I know. I think the march from the old village was harder than we expected. A couple of other elderly Deltans have died since they got here." I mentioned my theory about potential apprentices, and Marvin laughed. "I can think of at least two females from Archimedes' cohort who are actively working on that." "Yeah. Gotta love adolescence. Between his flint-napping skills, his tool-making ability in general, and his position as primary spokesperson for the Bob, Archimedes had a level of mojo totally out of keeping with his youth, all of which apparently went over quite well with the girls." Archimedes set aside the core and the tools, stood up, and stretched. He and Moses exchanged a few words, and Moses got up and wandered off. There was no 9-to-5 in Deltan society. Things got done when things got done. It looked like they'd had enough for the moment. Archimedes turned and looked around until he located the drone I was using to observe. He grinned up at me and made a head motion toward the practice range. I bobbed the drone in agreement, then floated after him as he headed in that direction. I opened the conversation. "Things are looking good. Everyone seems to have settled in." Archimedes nodded. He walked in silence for a few more moments. "Arnold is happy with the new village, Kermilot?" I had mentioned my name for the camp once without running it through the translator. Archimedes was trying to render the word phonetically. It was a valiant attempt, but no human would have recognized the sound. "Let's just go with your word for it, Archimedes. My language doesn't translate well into Deltan."
"Fine with me. That hurt my throat. Anyway, Arnold likes how we can defend the two access paths instead of the entire boundary."
Camelot was located on a small mesa that was surrounded by scree and cliffs most of the way around. It reminded me a little of an aircraft carrier, including a rocky bluff in the center resembling a carrier's control island. Two paths, about 120 degrees apart, were the only ways on or off the mesa, unless you could fly. It was a huge improvement over their old village, which had been just a clearing in the forest. Guarding against gorilloid attacks had been a full-time job at the old village, and they'd still been losing the battle. "Two people were killed in the last two hands of days, though, right?" I said. Archimedes shrugged.
"The gorilloids are a problem. They are always hungry. And there are so many on this side of the mountains. Guarding is a bigger job when people are away from the village."
All the more reason to make it less necessary to leave the village. I already had herding on my list of things to teach them. I still needed to find an appropriate herd animal to domesticate. I turned away from the drone window just long enough to sigh and shake my head. That to-do list just kept growing. I found myself in one of those all-or-nothing situations. I'd made a decision to help the Deltans avoid extinction. What had started as a small, anonymous intervention quickly turned into a full-time job as the Bob, resident sky god. I hoped eventually to be able to leave them to their own fate, but that probably wasn't in the cards for a generation or so. We had arrived at the practice range, so I dropped the topic. Practice range was a trumped-up description, of course. The range consisted of a flat area at the side of the steep embankment leading up to the central bluff. Deltans staked up targets on the slope, and they used these to practice the new technology of spear chucking. We watched for a few minutes. Most Deltans could get a spear into the right area, point first, most of the time. But actually hitting one of the targets was an accomplishment and usually resulted in a lot of dancing and taunts directed at the other students. Any thought of precision was an unreachable fantasy for most. Some Deltans were out and out terrible, and one or two couldn't get it through their heads that the spear had to fly point first. Those individuals generally stayed on pigoid hunting duty where the spear never left your hand. Archimedes was exceptionally good with the spear, but he lacked the upper body strength to get any kind of distance. When he reached full adulthood, though, he would be formidable. Arnold was the other prodigy in this new technology. He had an intuitive feel for anything that involved killing. A natural warrior, he'd been the first Deltan to kill a gorilloid with a hand axe, splitting the beast's skull with one blow. Arnold was almost as big as a juvenile gorilloid, so he generally got very little back talk. Arnold paced back and forth, helping individuals with their technique and yelling encouragement. I chuckled, without letting it play out through the drone. I'd rigged the translator to render his speech with an Austrian accent. It never got old. "How is it going with the medicine woman?" Archimedes asked, interrupting my train of thought. I cringed inwardly. One of the surprising things about Deltans was their lack of awe for the divine authority of the Bob. And Cruella took that philosophy to new heights. A tribe of primitive humans would have been hanging on to my every word, but Deltans were much more skeptical and inclined to question. My first attempt to introduce them to tents still smarted a little. Not so well. She either flat out doesn't believe most of what I say, or she just doesn't want to change her ways. I'm able to get the occasional concession, but it's an uphill battle. Archimedes grinned up at the drone. Welcome to my tribe. Maybe you should use one of the flying rocks on her. I laughed, not only at the comment, but at the fact that Archimedes was sounding so much like me. He'd picked up the concept of dry humor right away, but it was completely beyond any but maybe a half dozen other Deltans. And using a buster on the medicine woman was certainly tempting. A self-propelled 40-pound ball of steel impacting at Mach 1 didn't leave much room for argument. I'll take it under advisement. She's at least taken my suggestions for cleaning wounds. She's not completely closed-minded, just very conservative. Archimedes shrugged. He'd been dealing with that level of conservatism his whole life. It was a constant source of amusement to him that I was surprised by the attitude. We continued along the path, which led up to the top of the central bluff. It was a flat area, about the size of a small house. Completely exposed to the elements, it would be useless as a living space, but the view was spectacular. On a sunny day like this, many of the adolescent Deltans gathered here to do what teenagers did the universe over, get away from the adults. We endured a few moments of staring as Archimedes came over the crest, the football-sized drone hovering by his shoulder, but I was old news, and the kids soon went back to what they were doing. They appeared to be playing Rinjhaksa, a sort of pick-up sticks with betting. Again, I was struck by how very human-like these people were. We only had 2 data points as of yet, but I wondered if there was some universality about the way intelligent species developed and behaved. Archimedes waved at Diana, who sat with some of her friends. She smiled and waved back, then glared at the drone and turned away. Not my number one fan, for sure. I'd never given her any reason to hate me, as far as I knew. It might be as simple as competition for Archimedes' attention. Archimedes sat down, facing northeast toward the mountain range that split this section of the continent. I brought the drone down to a comfortable talking height and took a moment to enjoy the view. One of the 2 moons of Eden hung in the sky, twice the apparent size of Earth's moon. The sun, low in the west, imparted a golden highlight on the scattered clouds. The forest, stretching horizon to horizon, would have looked completely natural on Earth, before human beings clear-cut the planet. Archimedes gestured toward the mountains in the distance. Most of them were high enough to have snow year-round.
That's a big journey. It was hard with you leading us back here, when we knew what we were heading for. It must have been harder when our parents and their parents were going the other way and had no idea what they'd find.
He looked around at the village spread below us on the mesa.
It's so much better here. Except for all the gorilloids, of course.
Archimedes showed his teeth, which I automatically translated to a frown. That's good, Archimedes. I want to see your people succeed. I don't know if there are a lot of intelligent species in all the worlds of the sky, but each one is priceless. So far, my brothers haven't found any others.
How many Bobs are there?
I smiled at the question, but Archimedes couldn't see that. I don't really know. I made 4 others before I left the last star, but they will hopefully have made more. I've made 3 here so far. 2 have left, and Marvin is still here helping me.
You make brothers?
It's complicated, Archimedes. I'm not flesh and blood like you. Each brother I make is a copy of me with my memories and everything, but usually a little different in personality. Marvin is more cautious than me and tends to keep me from implementing wild plans. Archimedes stared at the drone for a few more seconds, then looked away.
Questions just bring more questions, and I never catch up. I should stick to things that affect my people.
I laughed, which the translation routine converted into the Delton expression of humor. That's fine, Archimedes. I have a very similar problem. I call it a to-do list. It only ever seems to get bigger. Archimedes grinned in response and turned to the vista spread out before us. He sat, and I hovered in silence, enjoying the scenery. 4. Water Planet. Mulder. October 2170, Eta Cassiopeiae. Eta Cassiopeiae was a long-period binary. The brightest of the pair, Eta Cassiopeiae A, was class G3V, only slightly larger and more luminous than Sol. At 19.5 light-years from Epsilon Eridani, it was a bit of a hike, but all of the closer good candidates were spoken for. As part of Bill's 3rd cohort, I had to take pot luck, I guess. Most stars are K and M class, and I just didn't see a tidally locked planet sitting practically inside the chromosphere of its parent star as being a desirable vacation getaway, so here I was, 20-odd years later. By now, Homer and Riker would have gotten to Sol, and whatever situation they found would be resolved, one way or another. I chuckled, remembering the early days back at Epsilon Eridani. Homer was a real card. I think he picked his name at least as much because it bugged the other Bobs as anything else. I wondered if Riker would kill Homer himself in a friendly fire incident. That made me laugh out loud, and Guppy looked at me with fishy concern. I lifted Spike off my lap and put her on the desk, then got up and stepped outside, into the sun. My VR was a tropical location, with open-air huts, reminiscent of Gilligan's Island. It would be totally impractical in the real world, of course, but in VR, you could do anything. Guppy followed me out.
Results are in. We have found no Jovians.
None? I frowned. I wonder if that's good or bad.
Insufficient information.
I nodded distractedly and turned back to face the beach. I took a minute to enjoy the sun on my face and listen to the surf. I suppose I might eventually get tired of this scene, but not anytime soon. It made me regret that I'd never taken the time for this kind of vacation when I was alive. Taking a deep breath, I stepped past Guppy and back into the hut. The holotank showed the layout of the star system with about 95% confidence at this point. There might be a few smaller bodies floating around that we'd missed, but I doubted they'd be major players. The companion star, Eta Cassiopeiae B, had a closest approach of 36 AU at periastron, which meant planets were unlikely outside of about 9 AU of ECA. It also meant that the Oort and Kuiper objects had been disturbed many times. Any planets in this system would have taken more than one good pelting. The good news was there was probably very little left out there to send inward. That one, I pointed to the 3rd planet, is right smack in the comfort zone. Any indication of size?
No, but spectroscopic analysis is showing oxygen and water lines.
Oh, that's excellent.
There is also indication of a wobble, which would indicate a satellite.
Better and better. Okay, Guppy, plot a course to Planet 3.
Deploy mining and survey drones?
Now, let's see if this system is worth hanging around in first. Guppy somehow managed to look disappointed. Although, if pressed, I couldn't for the life of me describe what a disappointed fish looked like. I stared in thought at the image floating in front of me. We'd detected 4 other rocky planets, 2 inside and 2 outside the comfort zone, but no Jovian planets. That worried me a little, as Jovians tended to keep the inner system relatively safe by perturbing anything coming straight in from the outer system. Of more concern was the lack of a significant asteroid belt. The general plan for the Heaven project was to use the mineral wealth of asteroid belts to build the space station and future Bobs. No asteroid belt could spell trouble. Meh, one thing at a time. It took a few days to get there. I spent that time doing fine scans of the system for any sparse asteroid belts that I might have missed. No such luck. This system really had been swept clean. I had 5 planets and whatever moons they might have to work with. Planetary mining would require a lot of rethink. I also got a bead on the moons of Planet 3. There were 2 bigger ones, one about half the size of Earth's moon and one about a fifth the size, and 2 smaller ones, closer in, really not much more than big rocks. The planet itself was a little smaller than Earth, with a 0.87 surface gravity and a 26-hour rotation. The atmosphere was delightfully Earth-like, maybe a little more oxygen-rich. I inserted myself into a polar orbit and started deep scans. The planet had a lot of cloud, just like Earth. That was good, since it indicated robust weather patterns. It also had a lot of water. In fact, so far, all I'd seen was water. Have we detected land yet?
Negative.
Well, that's irritating. Alert me as soon as we find something.
Aye. Scans are complete.
But you were supposed to alert me. Oh. I examined the scans and started to laugh. Honest to God, a good belly laugh still feels good, even in VR. The planet had water, all right. Oh, did it have water. What didn't it have? Land. None. Nada. Not so much as an atoll. This was just one big ball of ocean, not even any freaking ice caps to stand on. Which raised the question of what exactly was creating the oxygen. On Earth, that would be green plants, but plants, not to put too fine a point on it, tended to require dirt, excuse me, soil. Guppy, are you sure about the chlorophyll?
Affirmative.
Huh. Weird. I was obviously missing something. This would require a closer look. I'd gotten a message from Bill with plans for planetary exploration drones while I was still incoming, but with no raw materials to work with, I was pretty much SOL. I sighed theatrically and turned to Guppy, who was standing at parade rest as usual. I guess we'd better survey the system. Set a course to take us past each planet. Let's start with a flyby of this planet's moons.
Aye.
It took a couple of weeks to hit all the other planets and their satellites. While I was buzzing around, I did manage to catalog a couple of asteroids with relatively eccentric orbits. I sat back in my beach chair with a coffee in my hands and reviewed the reports. There was lots of metal in this system. It appeared to be a little richer than Sol, in fact. But everything was planet-side. It looked like the space junk that normally infests a system had virtually all become an impactor at some point. I could only guess that the effect of the binary partner, combined with the lack of a Jovian, had resulted in some weird chain of events that cleared the system. I'm sure an astrophysicist would have an explanation at the ready, and I promised myself I'd give that a think when I had the time. I flew out to the 4th planet, the 2nd moon of which had good ore deposits close to the surface. I set up the autofactory in orbit and fed several of my drones and roamers into it to use as construction material. A week later, the autofactory had built a couple of small cargo vessels. I loaded them up with mining drones and sent the whole crew down to the moon's surface. While I waited, I re-examined the scans of Planet 3 and pondered. I remembered reading that all of Earth's water could have been supplied by a single icy comet about 1,000 kilometers in diameter. Given the amount of material in Sol's Oort cloud, that was barely a sneeze. Since this system seemed to have had its cloud cleared, it wouldn't be too much of a stretch to think that the planets got pounded early on. While mining drones slaved away, I pondered the question of whether this world was even worth reporting as a colonization candidate. Oh, it had oxygen, and it had water, but the amount of effort required to build any kind of base would be incredible. I knew from the libraries that Earth in the 22nd century had started building and populating floating cities, but they operated only with the support of land-bound industries. Well, not my decision. I would just send in a report and let the powers that be hash it out. If there still were any powers that be, that is. The war could have wiped out humanity entirely, for all I knew, which would make this whole exercise moot. Still, eventually, Riker would report back to Bill, and Bill would transmit the news in one of his regular blogs. Until I heard different, I was going to continue to play von Neumann probe. I owed that to Dr. Landers.
Construction AMI controller is now online.
Cool. Thanks, Guppy. Order it to start on a couple of bobs, then the space station.
Aye.
The artificial machine intelligence could handle routine construction using standard plans and would contact me if it ran into any issues that were beyond its programming. The various construction tasks would take months, so I flew back to the third planet with a couple of exploration drones to look around. I started with a deep scan of the ocean and got my money's worth. I had to retune three times before I was able to detect ocean bottom. 800 kilometers deep. That was just nuts. I'd had some thought of artificial islands, but unless there was a Mount Look at That down there somewhere, there wasn't going to be anything close enough to anchor to or build up. I stared at the result in disbelief, then turned to Guppy. Start a detailed mapping survey of the ocean floor using the current sudar settings. Let me know when you have a complete globe.
Aye.
Telescopic surveys indicated some kind of green patches on the ocean, so I sent some drones down to investigate. It didn't take long to discover the source of the atmospheric oxygen. Plants had discovered that by sitting on top of the water, they could get much better light. The plants formed large mats, and by large, I mean literally kilometers in diameter. I dispatched a biology drone to take samples. The drones couldn't go underwater. That would just screw up the surge drive, something fierce. Even atmosphere required careful tuning to avoid futzing up the field. But sudar scans from in close revealed that the underwater ecosystem was rich beyond belief. Well, this is looking not so bad, suddenly. Assuming any of this is edible, people could live here and work upstairs. I looked at Guppy for a reaction. I might as well not have bothered. The biological drone spent weeks surveying the mats in immediate area. The mats actually seemed to be comprised of multiple species of plant in symbiotic relationships. The animals had found the free ride, and there was a thriving commensal zoological ecosystem in and on the mats. At the end of 2 months, I took the completed survey results and reviewed them. Biocompatible. And according to the report, exceptionally so. In fact, other than a few amino acids and vitamins, it looked like humans could go native on the mats, barring anything poisonous. I formatted a complete report and handed it off to the space station AMI to be transmitted to Bill once the station was completed. The Autofactory had completed a couple of computer matrices and cradles, so I did a backup and restored it into the matrices. HIC-3821-1 and HIC-3821-2 came online. I expanded my VR to make room for company and invited them in. Two bobs popped into existence across the desk from me. I offered them beach chairs and Jeeves brought coffee. I smiled at them. I guess you're wondering why I've gathered you here. H1 rolled his eyes. Funny. I knew you were going to say that. That got a chuckle from me and wasn't what I'd expected, so my clones were already diverging from me. So, got ideas for names? H1 piped up. Skinner for me. I made a moo of appreciation. Keeping to the theme, I'm touched. I'm more of a Johnny Quest type, H2 said. Skinner and I chuckled dutifully. After a polite pause, I pulled up the system schematic with the Autofactory area magnified in a cutaway view. Okay, you guys are going to be helping out around here until your hulls are ready to go. After that, it's up to you, of course. Both bobs nodded. Johnny said, No prob with the helping out, but I'm blowing this podunk system as soon as my vessel is ready. He turned to Skinner. It's up to you whether you want to stay or not. Personally, I'd rather go look for something a little more interesting. Well, that was a bit harsh. But his choice, of course. Skinner simply shrugged. I pointed to the image of the space station. The station is almost done. When it sends the report billward, we set the mining drones to automatic collection, and that really ends our responsibility here. Questions? Both Bobs shook their heads. I might stay for a while and do another round of Bobs, I continued. I'm curious about the life on 3. Poseidon would be a good name, I think.
Oh, naming it and everything. You are a sentimental sort.
Johnny was definitely a sarcastic SOB. I decided he couldn't leave soon enough for my tastes. Skinner seemed to agree with me as he was looking askance at Johnny. This seemed like Mario or Milo all over again. I remembered Bob 1 wondering what he'd do if he found he didn't like any particular clone. Turned out it didn't matter. It's a big galaxy. 5. Progress. Howard. December 2188. Omicron squared Eridani. The fence was all but finished. The town had been laid out, and now it had an official name. Landing wasn't particularly inventive, but everyone thought it was appropriate. I was on a conference call with Colonel Butterworth and Stefan, discussing the recent deaths. The colonel had his usual glass of Jameson. Stefan was calling in from the field, so his image was up in a separate window. Teleconferencing was certainly a lot easier than it had been in original Bob's lifetime, and it made things better for me, since in this context, I was as real as anyone else.
Two dead, Stefan repeated, shaking his head. A couple of raptors hid behind transport trucks hauling logs and simply walked into camp, staying out of sight. The beasts are tricky. Are we sure they aren't intelligent?
Colonel Butterworth cocked an eyebrow at him.
By which I assume you mean human-level sentient, and the answer is no. To the extent we can determine, I've discussed this with Dr. Sheehy and her staff, and they assure me that the raptors have no language beyond stereotyped verbal signaling. They use no weapons, not that they need any, and we see no evidence of structures.
He shrugged.
In the absence of some other form of evidence, they appear to be only animals. Very smart ones, but nothing more.
It doesn't have to be all or nothing, Colonel. Butterworth looked at me, one eyebrow still up.
I understand the philosophical point, Howard. However, in the real world, we are here to propagate our species. It is simply not possible to do that with a zero footprint. I would be happy to stop killing raptors if the raptors could be persuaded to stop trying to eat colonists.
He smiled.
Failing that, we and they will continue to interact in the ways that competing species have always handled such situations.
Stefan nodded and grinned at me.
And that is where we come in.
I knew there was no good answer to this discussion, and there were other things at the top of my mind. On another subject, are we on schedule to decant the rest of the colonists?
As long as the second farm donut is ready to go into full production, yes.
Butterworth took a sip of his whiskey and stared at it thoughtfully.
I'm going to have to start rationing this more stringently. The next barrel is 16 light years away, if any still exist at all.
He shook off the thought and looked at me. I ignored the comment about the Jameson. We're on schedule, Colonel. Bert and Ernie are anxious to get going back to Earth for another load. And in 35 years or so, another 20,000 people would have to find a place to settle on either Vulcan or Romulus. Would I still be here, or would I have handed it off to one of my clones by then? Stefan said,
Security is ready. The fence will be finished within 48 hours. Your observation drones are helping greatly.
I nodded to him. It's kind of ad hoc right now. Eventually, I'll want to put together a really good automated system. I turned back to the colonel. Farms are ready, and I'm building up a surplus in anticipation of need.
And we have adequate shelter, although many will live in barracks for another month or two.
Colonel Butterworth looked at each of us in turn.
I think we're ready. Please pass the word to the Exodus pilots.
I grinned. Finally, opening day. I accepted a ping from Bert and he popped into my VR. I saw that he was no longer wearing the Battlestar Galactica uniform. Well, the joke had been wearing a bit thin.
Hey, Howard, I just got your email. Butterworth has agreed to offload the balance of the column.